This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. It's been a big week in space exploration. SpaceX's Falcon Heavy blasted off from Cape Canaveral yesterday, and for the first time, the private space company also stuck the landing for all three of its reusable boosters. Not so successful was an Israeli company's mission to land a spacecraft on the moon. Bereshit came close to the lunar surface before Mission Control lost contact with the lander. Today on Intersection, we're talking about the ups and downs of the week in space. We're live with a panel of experts, and we're taking your calls. Did you trek out to the coast to watch the Falcon Heavy? Did you follow the progress of Bereshit on its perilous mission to the moon? And what about that incredible image of a black hole? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us your comments and questions on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio, Emily Speck, who covers space for WKMG. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me back.
Also joined by Brendan Byrne, 90.7 Space Reporter. Thank you, Brendan.
Always a pleasure.
On the line, we have Dale Ketchum, Vice President of Government and External Relations with Space Florida. Dale, thanks again for being with us.
Glad to do it.
And Julia Bergeron, she's a space history docent, photographer, and chronicler of the SpaceX fleet. Julia, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Julia, I want to start with you for a moment. I know you've got to run, but let's just talk about the launch of Falcon Heavy yesterday evening. It had been delayed a few times. There was a lot of interest in this launch, right? The kind of cars were lining up along the roads with anywhere with a good sort of sight line to the launch pad. What was it like sort of seeing that whole thing play out?
It was really a wonderful experience. I viewed from Titusville. I chose to not risk the traffic. We didn't know what was going to happen with all of the traffic last year versus this year. So I chose to view from home, which is about 12 miles from the pad, and I can tell you US 1 in Titusville was quite packed this year.
So you mentioned the launch last year. You're talking about when SpaceX launched the Tesla into orbit, or into space, I should say.
Yeah, that's like the debut of Falcon Heavy.
Does it bring back memories of the shuttle program or even launches before that era?
I feel like we are starting to see that come back to Titusville and areas along the Space Coast. It's a little bit different picture than what people used to see during shuttle and Apollo. You see cell phones recording instead of people looking up, but they're still looking up. It's just they have a new way to record that action.
Now, one of the things you do is launch photography, amateur photography, and space history. And I'm wondering how this launch fits into the kind of continuum of space exploration based out of the Kennedy Space Center.
It's an interesting contrast. It's almost like a renaissance. So now our 45th Space Wing has commercial partners, which is a lot different than earlier when it was primarily NASA and running these really big missions. So these commercial space partners like SpaceX, Blue Origin, United Launch Alliance are really adding kind of a new excitement. So when people are coming to the History Center, they're there to kind of talk about the next upcoming launch, but they're also there to learn about how we got there.
How much awareness is there of the launches and the rockets and the programs that came before?
I'd say there's a pretty good knowledge. I think that the gap is really in the understanding that the heart of the program really started at the Air Force Station, and then Kennedy Space Center was added on to support the human spaceflight program because you needed an awful lot of room to support that program and all of its capsules and vehicles. So that gap is kind of learning how we became more geared from our missile history into our human spaceflight history.
And now we're in the next phase of that, the next era, so to speak.
Absolutely. So some of those pads are being reborn again, and that's really exciting to see.
Julia, what are you looking forward to next? I know there's a few big things coming up this summer, potentially later this summer. You get the sense there's going to be as much interest, if not more, in those launches that you've seen for this one and the one last year?
I think the interest is definitely going to build as the astronauts are getting ready for their commercial flights. I'm hoping by the end of this year But in the meantime, it sounds like we're going to get a spectacular fireworks show when the launch abort test happens for SpaceX. So that's kind of exciting to see an intentional rapid disassembly.
And that sounds kind of a little bit inside baseball, but do you get a lot of crowds for those kinds of things as well? You have to sort of be in the know about that.
I think we will for that one.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one more thing before I let you go, Julia. You also have something on your Twitter feed about baking cookies for the team when there's a launch. Just explain how that goes down.
Oh, well, that actually stems from a shuttle tradition. So we have a lot of traditions out there, one of them being baked beans during shuttle. But another maybe lesser-known tradition was the chocolate chip cookies that Dottie would bake for the astronauts when they were in quarantine. I have the recipe for that, and those cookies get shared with our commercial partners, the media team, and they also go out with the SpaceX suite.
Do you have a commercial oven or something? That would be a lot of cookies, I imagine.
No, I wish I did. They're all done from home, but if somebody like Blue Origin ever wanted to lend me maybe a sharing oven, that would be spectacular.
Wow, you'd probably be able to cook those cookies pretty quickly too, I imagine.
Well, you bet.
Julia Bergeron, space history docent, photographer, and chronicler of the SpaceX fleet, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Emily, I want to bring you into this conversation now. Why do you think this launch was such a big deal for spectators? Just the amount of interest in it has been quite spectacular, right?
Yeah, well, it's currently the most powerful rocket that's launching, and this was the only second flight. You know, Julia was talking before about Demo 1. It was the test flight where Elon Musk sent his Tesla Roadster with Starman into a wide Mars orbit, and that was really exciting, but it was a test flight. It wasn't a paying customer on board that. This was a paying customer, so it's the first mission, per se, for Falcon Heavy. Mm-hmm. And then it's so exciting because, like I said, it's powerful. It's 27 Merlin engines, 5 million pounds of thrust. It's a big rocket. And then that triple booster landing is kind of the cherry on top. So, it definitely drew crowds. With the delay one day from Wednesday to Thursday, we did see a slightly smaller crowd than on Wednesday. I don't know if Brendan also noticed that, but a lot of people were out. There were international travelers here that, mm-hmm. you know, extended their stays just to see Falcon Heavy. So it does generate a big wow factor, that's for sure.
Any frustration because, you know, delays are sort of part and parcel of the launch process, right? Were people getting a bit mad when the rocket didn't go up and they had to jump in their cars and head home again?
I don't know if mad, but it's just, you know, it's frustrating. I know there were a couple people, my coworker Eric Sandoval, he talked to this woman who extended her stay, I think from Germany, and paid however much, and she burst into tears he was speaking to her because she wasn't going to see the launch now because she couldn't afford to extend her flight. So, I mean, frustration and disappointment, yes, but you know, I did a little like Falcon Heavy beginner's guide before the launch because I kept getting so many questions about it. And that was one of the things that I put in there was launches do delay. They do scrub. There are a lot of reasons why. And that's just something you got to build into your patience factor for mm-hmm. sure.
Got to approach it a little bit like a space engineer, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about space exploration, the week in space exploration on 90.7's Intersection. You can join the conversation. Call us at 1-866-338-5252. Were you one of the people who made the trip out and watched it from the side of the road? Perhaps you watched it from the beach. Want to hear your impressions and some of the other things happening in space news this week? You can send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Dale Ketchum with Space Florida, I want to bring you into this conversation. Your big thing at Space Florida has been sort of pushing commercial space. So to see this successful launch, those three boosters make it all the way back, one of them out to sea, I believe, and then the others on the landing pad on land. Pretty exciting, right?
Oh, there's no question as Emily mentioned, the first one was for show, putting a Tesla in orbit really effectively around Mars with Starman and a soundtrack. Nonetheless, that was the pretty much the most spectacular thing we've seen in space almost since Boots on the Moon. Mm-hmm. And it was, of course, classic Elon. But that one was for show. This one was for business. And I think that's a big part of what everybody's coming to understand more clearly is this was a big launch for Elon because he got a big check from the Saudi Arabians when he put their satellite into orbit. And that's why they do this. This is a business. It's those resources that are provided by the commercial sector that drive the innovation and the spectacular imagery and get everybody excited to want to come watch the launch of a huge vehicle and the recovery of the boosters. I mean, it's a bucket list thing for a heck of a lot of people. And those of us who live here, I think we recognize how lucky we are to be able to see that stuff.
Indeed. And it sounds like from what Emily was saying, a lot of folks coming from even other countries as well to watch this launch. I mean, the idea, though, Dale Ketchum, that there's some kind of element of theater to some of what SpaceX does, at least, how important do you think that is in sort of making sure that there is this continual sort of hum of interest in what's happening on the Space Coast and what's happening in commercial space generally? Because there is this kind of sense that every time there's a launch, you're not quite sure what to expect from the likes of Elon Musk. He does like to amp up the drama sometimes. Is that a good thing?
Oh, very much so. I think if for no other reason, you have to remember probably the biggest single challenge that these companies face is recruiting talent, because they're demanding a very high level of skill sets that are competing, because software drives so much of what all of this, what we're able to witness and be awestruck at is driven by software. And they have to recruit talent from a lot of other, you know, from Google and Apple and Facebook, who pay a lot of money. So being able, it's in Elon's nature, but it works very well for him to have an ambiance of just ultra cool, and just everything about it is just so amazing. And that helps him recruit the talent that he needs. So there's a business element to it, but also, if you know Elon, that's who he is.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the week in space news here on Intersection. I want to hear from you as well. Were you watching that launch? Were you following the path of the Beresheet lander as it made its way towards the moon? And what about your disappointment, I guess? Or was there some disappointment when communication was lost with that lander? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Brendan, tell us about that lander. So close, but still so far. But there was kind of a message of hope, I guess, from those flight control engineers. They're saying, look, we got pretty close. This is still a successful mission in our eyes.
Yeah, it was a really big deal for them to do what they did. Just to put into perspective, this is a tiny lander working on a $100 million budget, going places that less than a handful of people have actually been to. For them to just get into orbit around the moon was a huge deal, doing it the way that they did it. And so, you know, landing is kind of an afterthought at that point. That was the biggest deal. We got some sound from the landing. Here's a listen to Ofer Doran of SpaceIL. He's the Israeli nonprofit behind the mission.
We had a failure in the spacecraft. We unfortunately have not managed to land successfully. We are the seventh country to orbit the moon and the fourth to reach the moon's surface. And it's a tremendous achievement up to now.
And here's Morris Kahn. He's the billionaire entrepreneur and backer of that mission.
Well, we didn't make it, but we definitely tried. And I think that the achievement of getting to where we got is really tremendous. I think we can be proud.
Yeah, so they're very proud of what happened, even though it didn't land on the surface. And Google, the original prize to get there, they ended up canceling the prize because they didn't meet certain deadlines, but they actually did give them $1 million prize for landing. So that's something to write home about there.
Mm-hmm. There's this kind of emotional attachment that people developed, whether it's like a Mars rover or some other kind of spacecraft, you know, zooming around in the far reaches of the galaxy. What about this one? I mean, were people sort of invested in this? It was not quite as long a mission, of course, just about a week, but people seem kind of invested in its success, right?
And that was intentional. That is what this whole program kind of started in Israel, was to kind of inspire the next generation of you know, or engineers and scientists that would work on these missions. So, you know, the SpaceIL team went to middle and high schools and talked about the story, and, you know, they had a children's book about the spacecraft. And that was the point, is to have this kind of Apollo effect elsewhere and get more people involved in the space program. And here, you know, there, I mean, there were thousands, tens of thousands of people were watching this happen live. Mm. And I have to give credit to SpaceIL for, you know, having us watch this moment where there was, you know, a very high risk of them failing, but they were letting us watch it in real time. I don't know about you, Emily. I was on the edge of my seat when they've lost communication with it in the last few kilometers of the landing. But, yeah, you know, you get connected to these things. You want to see them succeed. And I was right there with them yesterday.
Were you a bit emotional about it, Emily?
Oh, yeah. It was – yeah. That was tough because, well, the live – yeah, it's great that they live streamed it. And then not only that, but Mission Control had an audience behind them with a glass window. You could see. So not only are they're working, they're communicating with the spacecraft, they're, you know, all their hopes and dreams are in this landing in about under 30 minutes, and there's a whole audience behind them. I can't imagine that pressure. And the live stream was in Hebrew, so we couldn't understand a lot of it, but once in a while, you know, they would pipe in with, you know, just a quick English update for us. Who don't speak Hebrew. So and a lot of the commenters were from the US or other English speaking countries, and I think they were frustrated for that reason, but it's an Israeli mission, so, you know. But yeah, it was really emotional. I mean, I was sitting in the newsroom and I might have been the only person paying attention, but everyone was watching the look on my face as things were not going well. And so, yeah, but that was tough. But like Brendan said, I mean, the amount of kids that were probably inspired by this mission, that's really important. And I think that was the overall goal. And the goal was to get to the moon. And, and they did get there.
Not as gracefully as they hoped.
Yes,
but
not as gracefully. But, you know, and they did successfully orbit the moon. I think they're the 12th country to do that. I believe I'd have to fact check myself there. But so that's also exciting. And
even just getting there it's a massive achievement, right? I was watching this little animation last night of how they kind of used the Earth's gravity to slingshot them into the gravity of the moon. And they're just watching these little parabolas this thing made to get to the moon is pretty incredible.
It is really incredible. So I'm hoping that out of this, well, we don't really know what's next for them. They did get $1 million from the Lunar X Prize, even though that, you know, competition ended without someone successfully getting there by the end of 2017. But maybe there's more for SpaceIL. I don't know. So
I think
we'll see.
This is also going to lead the discussion about kind of preserving the moon and space debris on the moon. And there were a few people that were up in arms about that because, you know, it did crash. And, you know, the Lunar X Prize, they had a heritage clause where if you could land near one of the Apollo sites, you got extra cash. But there's a lot of people that want to protect those sites. And if you've got this uncontrolled landing, then you might not do that. So, you know, there's this call to, okay, well, if this company can do it for $100 million, what other companies are going to do that? And should we start having the conversation as to, okay, where are they going to put these on the moon? Could they possibly mess with, you know, some of these heritage sites that are there? So I think it's going to lead to a very interesting conversation down the road about how do we protect the moon from space debris that's going to be on the lunar surface.
I want to get back to the launch of the Falcon Heavy for a moment. We've got a question from listener Lawrence who writes in on Twitter. Can Dale Ketchum comment on others entering the fray like Blue Origin and Firefly? Dale, where are we at with some of those other companies and kind of their launch plans?
Well, Blue is making their steady progress. I mean, if you're familiar with them, they say that slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And they are, you know, they're just marching along. That the facility is becoming increasingly active with new equipment coming in to do amazing things. We walked through there just last week with the lieutenant governor, and they have it's going to be awesome. And that's just the facility across the street from our office. And the work that's going on out at the pad is that's going to be the largest pad ever. It is huge. They're still doing all the work in the ground before they come up. But Blue is doing what Blue does, and they just work, and they don't draw a lot of attention to themselves. Firefly is we should be breaking ground, hopefully, before the end of the summer on their rocket manufacturing facility, which will be right across the street from Blue Origins. They build a smaller rocket, and it's about 95 feet tall, if you can call that small. But compared to Blue's, it's smaller. But also, hopefully, Relativity as well is going to be launching from out there on LC-16 before too long. So there's growth is continuing, and then behind all of that is SpaceX's Starship, which is doing their test hopping, as it were, in Brownsville, and that is going to be a Goliath of a vehicle, unlike anything anyone has ever seen.
Right.
So things are getting busy and interesting.
Things are hopping indeed. Just a little bit of a throwback to some space history, Brendan. Yuri's Night, what's going on with that this weekend?
Yeah, so this weekend it's the global celebration of Yuri Gagarin's first flight, so the first human in space. And this had been something that had been done in pockets of the area throughout the country. There was a big party in L.A. every year, and last year for the first time they had it at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. They're going to have it this Saturday, and what's really cool is it's all about learning about space and learning about stuff. So you're under Atlantis, and there's folks that are going to be there to help answer questions. So last year, Emily was an ambassador, kind of talking to people. This year, I'll be one of the ambassadors along with some launch photographers. We've got some planetary scientists who are going to be out there, astronomers. So if you basically see any of us out there with a red sash, you can ask us any question about space.
So it's like a kind of a live and in-person AMA. I mean, for folks who've never been to one of these
basically.
Things, what do they expect?
It's a big party. There's a DJ, there's drinks, there's all sorts of cool art and stuff. So it was I had so much fun last year. I was surprised at how much fun I had hanging out under the shuttle, and I'm really excited about going back this year.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking to Julia Bergeron earlier about sort of how she kind of helps people, guide people through the history of space. Sounds like a lot of people, you know, this is kind of an extension of what she does.
Yeah.
There's people who are definitely interested in space. There's different levels of engagement and knowledge about space history, and it's a chance to learn a bit and have some fun while you're doing it.
Yeah, there's some great speakers. The keynote speaker is a private astronaut, so he went to the International Space Station. Some of the other ambassadors are Tom Cross. He's this amazing rocket photographer. He's going to be out there. Chris Gebhardt, amazing space journalist. Actually, one of my former teachers from Stoneman Douglas High School will be there.
Oh, wow.
Kyle Jeter, he's the astronomy teacher there. So he's going to be one of the speakers as well. So it'll be really neat to see everybody.
Mm-hmm. Emily Speck, I want to just ask you one more thing. I know this wasn't necessarily something you were paying a huge amount of attention from your story coverage perspective, but that black hole, the image of a black hole, reflect on that for a moment.
Well, that was really cool. It kind of, as far as getting interest in planetary science and space exploration, I mean, nothing else can do it like a blurry photo of a black hole, you know? Everyone was kind of hating on that, but it was
a coffee stain.
Right. Yeah. It kind of looked like that. But, and like I said, I haven't covered this extensively, so I'm not going to go into the science or anything. But what made that happen? What made that photo happen? The data that went behind that and this photo, I mean, it was very impressive. Mm-hmm. And so I hope it gets people to ask more questions. And they certainly were on Twitter. So
I have to say, the most interesting thing about that was there was so much data collected that they couldn't transmit it over the internet. They actually snail mailed all of the data to where it needed to go.
Wow. Because
they literally turned the Earth into a telescope. Like it was like 8 to 10 radio telescopes were all pointing on the same spot. And like that in itself is really cool. And this now gives them a really good case to say, hey, let's put one of these radio telescopes up in space.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be very exciting to see what science comes after this initial finding.
Absolutely.
And the numbers are mind-boggling, right? I mean, the
petabytes or whatever. I couldn't even tell you how much it was. Yeah.
Indeed. Just another comment here from a listener. Nathan writes in on Twitter, the Beresheet mission wasn't a complete failure. They created a new crater on the moon, Beresheet Crater. Brendan, kind of to your point about maybe the care and precision that's needed in some of these missions, depending on how close they get to those historical sites.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that NASA's been working on, and it's something that I believe there'll be a discussion about, and there's some other organizations out there, like For All Moonkind, that are really lobbying for those efforts. So.
Mm-hmm. Brendan Byrne, 90.7 Space Reporter, thanks for getting us caught up to date on the week in space exploration.
Anytime.
Also joined by WKMG's Emily Speck. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you.
And Dale Ketchum calling in from Colorado. He's the Vice President of Government and External Relations with Space Florida. Dale, thank you as well.
Always glad to do it.
Still to come, many of us get our best ideas in the shower. That's kind of what happened to Sean Seipler. We'll talk to Seipler about his non-profit that recycles hotel soap. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Ever wonder what happens to the soap you leave in the hotel bathroom when you check out? Sean Seipler took that question and turned it into a non-profit. Clean the World now recycles discarded soap from 5,000 hotels and sends it to communities in need. And the non-profit's Orlando headquarters now boasts what's been called the first of its kind, a museum of soap, featuring the collection of Louis and Fortuna spits. I caught up with Seipler at the museum's ribbon cutting.
So we're standing in the middle of the Soap Story, which is the first of its kind soap museum that's being launched here at Clean the World's headquarters in Orlando, Florida. Mm-hmm.
And how long have you all been working out of this space at Clean the World? Like, how did that idea come about?
We've been in this specific space for a year, but it's been 2 years in the making as we've developed a relationship with Louis and Fortuna Spits and saw their amazing collection and were really given the opportunity to display their collection. So this location was moved into with the idea that we would launch this soap museum. And so we had this beautiful, perfect room to be able to build it out in, and here we are.
When you got that call from Louis, what went through your mind? It must have been a slightly unusual phone call for you.
It was quite unusual. His persistence was notable, and so when we started researching and saw the work that he did, the books that he had, which displayed his collection, it was immediate. Like, wow, this is really incredible and important for Clean the World. But it was weeks after when we or months after when we really understood that we would be able to take this collection and display it, and that's really where it's just incredible, because this is the historical reference of soap and about it being a soap saves lives concept is exactly what Clean the World is all about. That's what we're doing in so many communities across the globe. So this is really a full kind of 360 for us to be able to display this, knowing what we do on a daily basis here at Clean the World.
Do you already have folks who come to see what you do in your factory anyway? Like, do you get a lot of visitors anyway?
Yeah, so we have about 10,000 volunteers a year that come through this facility. So now when they come to volunteer, they'll be able to view the soap museum on their way in to volunteer.
And what stands out for you about this collection? What's the most interesting thing about it?
Well, I happen to be a Chicago Cubs fan, and Wrigley is known for their gum, but we actually have a bar of soap from 1893, which was the original Wrigley product. It was a bar of soap. They pivoted from soap to gum in the early 1900s, but being a big Cubs fan, having that bar of soap from 1893, the Wrigley bar, really stands out to me. And that's one of about 1,000 different items in here that are just so unique and so special, and love folks to come out here and check it out.
Did you know before that Wrigley used to make soap before they got into gum?
I had no idea. It was sitting in their home in Chicago when I was told the story of Wrigley, and that really just sort of blew me away that's where they started.
It sounds like you've got a good friendship now with the owner of the collection, but when you kind of first heard about it, you're like, well, who collects soap memorabilia? Who does that?
It is, it's amazing to think that. Then when you go to their home and see the collection, which takes up almost every square inch of their amazing, immaculate home in the north suburbs of Chicago, you understand why they did it. When they speak to you and tell you about each one of these historical items and where they came from and the importance to history and to just the industrialization of beauty and hygiene products and what that means, it's really amazing. I'm so grateful that this couple decided to do this, because if not for them, there is no other collection of this kind anywhere around the world. And so now we're able to display it and show folks its importance.
Just real quick for listeners who might not be familiar with what you do, what's your elevator pitch? What does Clean the World actually do?
Yeah, well, Clean the World's a global nonprofit. We work with 5,000 hotels across the globe to take the used soaps and bottled amenities when the guests are done with them. We recycle those items and distribute them to children and families all over the world who, in so many cases, we are literally saving their lives.
And does that all happen here in this factory?
That happens here. We also have facilities in Las Vegas, Montreal, Hong Kong, London. So we're a global organization. We've sent 45 million bars of soap to kids and families in 127 countries globally. And since the day we've launched, we've seen a 35% reduction in the death rate to children under the age of 5 that are dying to hygiene-related illnesses.
They say that people often get good ideas when they're in the shower. Is that where you got the idea for this?
Pretty much. I was in a hotel room in Minneapolis when I called the front desk one day and asked what happened to the soap, and I was done using it. They said it was thrown away. I did some quick research and math and figured out that we were throwing away millions of bars of soap every day out of hotels across the U.S. And at the time that we launched, there were 9,000 children that were dying every day to hygiene-related illnesses. And all these studies we found showed if we just gave them soap and taught them how and when to wash their hands, that we could cut those deaths in half. So, yes, this almost came out of the shower.
Thanks for your time, Sean.
Thank you very much.
That was Clean the World CEO Sean Seipler. So why would anyone spend a lifetime collecting soap memorabilia? Meet Louis and Fortuna Spitz.
I am Fortuna.
And I'm Louis.
So we're standing in the soap museum here at Clean the World. This is just a fraction of your collection, I understand.
It's part of our collection, yes.
How do you come to collect soap memorabilia? How did that all start?
It started because I started in the world of bar soaps as a chemical engineer for an armor and company in Chicago, the makers of Dial soap. And since then, I never left the soap. So it was being a chemical engineer, process development, working in the making, the packaging, and soap. And as years went by, I also became a representative of Italian companies for the manufacturing and packaging and soap. And we realized, both my wife Fortuna and I, that there is a marvelous history about soaps, the importance of what it has done for mankind, specifically for health, hand washing, a big area that Clean the World is involved in, and then beauty, because beauty soaps were and are still in vogue, and then hygiene, which combines it all. So it's a lifetime dedicated to one simple product, which is enormously important: soap and water, and soap saves lives.
How did you hear about Clean the World, and what gave you the idea to donate some of your collection or have it on display down here in Orlando?
2 years ago, we met because he gave a lecture in one of the conferences that I put together in soaps, and we met 2 years ago, and we saw the opportunity to enhance his operation and the meaning of his dedication to soap with our desire to let the larger number of people see our collection, not just to come to our, but to and we're in a better place than Orlando, where families and children come to visit and visit Disneyland, is the best combination.
Fortuna, what does your house look like? Is every wall covered in soap memorabilia? Do you have any space in your garage?
Yes, we have some in the garage too. But actually, we built the house to show the collection 21 years ago. So we have special balconies that go to the family room that are with glass, so that the main collection of the pear soaps can be seen from upstairs, from downstairs to upstairs.
And then in the basement, it's set up like a museum with lights and different, but it's still a museum approach.
So who comes to visit it? Do you open it up to school groups and the like?
We don't do that. We open it up to smaller groups, not school groups. That's more very complicated. But, garden club and other friends that come. We never wanted to open it up to the public because it's set up to, in a private home to do that. It's very complicated. So very happy to be able to open it up to the public here.
We have found such a good home for the collection. And we hope that as they keep growing, we will be giving more of the collection to them. So to keep the collection together, that's the main important thing for us.
Are you still collecting soap memorabilia?
Well, it's getting a little bit more difficult because we only collect now unique pieces that we might not have. But we never stop collecting. A collector, a hobbyist is a hobbyist and a collector for life.
Was there ever a point, Fortuna, at which you were like, okay, this has got to stop. This is too much. You've got to stop collecting soap stuff.
Well, I still look around, and if there's something very special, we get it for the collection.
Yeah. It has to be special.
What's the most meaningful piece in this particular collection here in Orlando for you?
There isn't one. There are several. And it's difficult to tell because each has its niche of uniqueness. So I will not commit to that.
One thing I'm curious about is Sean mentioned something about the history of soap operas and how that is a history that people aren't quite aware of. How did that come about? Like, what is the connection between soap and television?
I really mean that instead of me telling it, there's a marvelous, very short display from radio to TV, and we tell it about it. We tell the story. It started with radio, with Ma Perkins, which is a lady that sold Oxydol, which was a powder soap from Procter & Gamble. Then for 30, from the 30s and the 50s when the radio became TV, then people said, well, who was involved selling soap, so to speak, was Procter. So he said, well, that's the soap opera. So the name came because it started with radio, it started with Procter & Gamble, we started with a soap product. If you want to read about it or learn more about it or just take a picture of the wall, it tells a very good story.
Thank you so much for your time.
We thank you for approaching us, and I hope that your audience will come and visit. It will be fun for them, educational and fun. It's a good combination. Best luck to you. Thanks for approaching us.
Thank you.
It was lovely to converse with you, and please tell your friends to come and see the soap story.
That was Louis and Fortuna Spitz, and you can see their collection of soap memorabilia at the Clean the World headquarters in Orlando. Details on our website, wmfe.org.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last April. Still to come, the deadline's fast approaching for NPR Music's Tiny Desk Contest. Thousands of bands have entered over the last 4 years for a chance to perform at NPR's Tiny Desk space in Washington, D.C. Here at WMFE, we'll be highlighting Central Florida musicians who enter a video in the contest. Coming up, we'll hear from one of last year's fan favourites, John Corbell. Intersection's back in a minute.
Stupid, stupid, stupid is how I often feel. Risking sidelong glances while in the church we kneel. You, the classroom.
This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The Tiny Desk Contest from NPR Music is back. Thousands of artists and bands from across the country have entered in the contest over the last 4 years. And last year, more than 30 entries came from the Central Florida area. Unsigned bands and musicians can submit videos until the Sunday, April 14th. They're competing for a chance to perform at the Tiny Desk space at NPR headquarters in DC, and the winners will also go on tour with NPR Music. We want to celebrate Central Florida musical talent by highlighting local acts who submit a video, and we'll invite some of the bands to a live taping of Intersection next month. Here's John Corbell, one of last year's listener favourites, performing at WMFE's Zippo'd Throwdown at the Timucua White House.
She was Judas's silver, 30 pieces of pain. With coin of desire, somehow I felt no shame. From the moment I touched her, I knew what I would be. She was Judas's silver, in the Judas's me.
Corbell's EP is called Earthlight. He joined us in the studio for a conversation about his music.
So talk to me about your song Judas's Silver. You introduced it at the live event as a song about, quote, religious cheating. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's kind of a song where I took some imagery that, you know, everybody's familiar with in terms of a turncoat. But I put it in the context of somebody that's conflicted about cheating on their spouse. So it's using some images that people can relate to, but also kind of the old country western idea of a cheating song.
Beauty, a trap lead for a fool. I reach for the prize, but I'm making my mark.
Now, you've performed at Timucua before. What does it mean for a musician like yourself to have access to a venue like the Timucua Arts Foundation?
Well, for anyone that's familiar with the White House, as they call it over there, it's such an intimate setting, first off. You have an audience that's right there up close and personal.
It's literally Benoit's living room.
It's his living room, is his den and his rehearsal hall for his, he does his own practicing. Benoit Glaser was the music director for many years of La Nuba at Disney and Cirque du Soleil. And he has developed this venue over a long number of years. And it's just a real treasure for our area. And I was lucky enough to perform there for a full concert a while back, and I hope to do it again. It's just such a great venue.
So tell me about the song Sing.
Again, that was one that kind of came together both as a musical challenge in terms of the way the progression is structured and everything, and also to come up with the idea of expressing yourself beyond what you think your capabilities are, and, you know, reaching for something stronger and greater. The hook is sing like you're already there. You know, and it's also, I think, a little bit of a self-pep talk for me to want to expand what I'm doing and grow as an artist.
Speaking of singing, you really throw yourself into the vocal side of your performance. You clearly get a lot of enjoyment out of performing. Who inspires you? Like, where do you draw your sense of performance from as far as other artists?
I guess to look back over the years, my influences early on included the late, great Al Jarreau, who I saw in his last Orlando performance at the Plaza Live a couple years ago. He was a big inspiration to me, as well as Michael Franks is a big influence. There are tons of influences. I really see Sting as an influence, especially when he began his solo career, you know, going beyond what he did with the Police. More recently, I listened to a lot of Kurt Elling, who was a wonderful jazz singer, and his writing is really fascinating to me as well. They don't talk about his songwriting as much because he's such an amazing jazz interpreter, but I enjoy all of his stuff. As far as vocally, though, you know, I think that a lot of what I do as a singer comes from an experience of having sung with a big eight-piece horn band years ago up in the Philadelphia area where I'm originally from. Singing with three horn players and a whole big rhythm section, you've got to be able to power beyond that. I think for better or worse, that's where a lot of my vocal firepower comes from, is having to have competed with that lineup.
Tell me about the EP. You've been hard at work promoting it, and you're getting ready to go on a tour, but you recorded this up in Nashville, and Nashville, of course, is more associated with country music, but you managed to find some artists there to take part in the recording. How did that all turn out?
Yes, well, it's really tremendously fortunate. First off, I've had an association with a really great producer in Nashville, Art Ward, his company Century Music Group. I've been doing projects with him for a number of years. And when we came up with the plan to do the Earthlight EP, first off, we wanted to tap into the more bossa nova and Latin and that aspect of my writing. And so the tunes that we selected to record reflect that. And then we were fortunate also in that we were able to get on the session a bunch of guys that routinely played together. They were already very familiar with one another from this thing called the Nashville Jazz Workshop. Most folks, as you said, associate Nashville with country music, as well they should, but the guys that do that studio work in Nashville are all really amazing musicians. And for the Earthlight session, we were able to get, for instance, Marcus Finney on drums, who was on the Grammy-winning album with Taj Mahal and Keb Mo this year, and also did the tour with them. We had Joe Davidian on piano, who was teaching at Belmont University at the time, but he's in New York now, performing at in the jazz world in New York. and Chris West on saxophone, and really a tremendous lineup. Mm-hmm. So we were really fortunate, and these guys, having played together quite a bit, had a tremendous chemistry. They fed off of each other really well, and that, I think, comes through on the record.
What's the story behind your track, Last Year of Innocence?
It has a pretty important personal meaning to me because the idea behind it came from a book, from a memoir that my older brother wrote like I said, it's a memoir of his eighth grade year in the little Catholic school that we went to in outside of Philadelphia there. And in the book, he relates a lot about this sort of little crush that he had on a girl in his eighth grade year. And when you're a kid and you have an older brother like that, you never really think of him as being this romantic, you know. But it came through in the book, and I was really struck by it. So I extracted different things from the book and incorporated it into the song. And then since we were already in the planning stages of this Bossa Nova project that Earthlight turned into, it really was a natural fit to write the song in that vein with that kind of rhythm going.
Well, John Corbell has an EP out called Earthlight. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stupid, stupid, stupid is how I often feel.
And that interview first aired on Intersection last May. Entries closed for the NPR Music Tiny Desk contest this Sunday. You can find more details about the contest over on our website, wmfe.org. We'll highlight the videos entered by Central Florida musicians, and you get to choose your favourites. We'll also invite a few to perform at a live taping of Intersection next month. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Production assistance for this week's show from Abe Abaraya, Juan Gualda, and Danielle Pryor. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to help bring you the conversations and reporting you hear on Intersection. Your contributions support our in-depth local programming, whether it's political analysis, reporting on the environment, healthcare, spaceflight, and education, or conversations with Central Florida filmmakers, authors, artists, and musicians. Support our Spring Silent Drive by renewing your annual contribution or making an additional gift of support. And if you're not a member of WMFE yet, make that first step and become a sustaining member. Call 1-800-785-2020 or visit WMFE.org. That's 1-800-785-2020 or WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
With all too real a girl discussing tribulations in all too real a world, our lives will be so different from many lives before. No teacher could prepare us for 1964. Oh, angel of St. Gabriel, why do things move so fast? Every time I tried to know you, I'd let the moment